From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. On June 24th, the Supreme Court of the United States overturned its 1973 ruling of Roe versus Wade and gave the states the power to decide abortion laws. That ruling was an unprecedented power grab, according to Dr. David Adler, who says it relegates women to second-class citizenship. Dr. Adler is a constitutional scholar, and he has led leadership positions at Boise State University, the University of Idaho, as well as Idaho State University. And he speaks and writes frequently on the Constitution and presidential power. He is the current president of the Alturas Institute, which is a nonprofit group created to promote the Constitution, as well as gender equality and civic education. He will be talking about recent Supreme Court decisions regarding religion, gun violence, and abortion this Thursday at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Boise State University, and he is joining us right now to talk more. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Adler.
Thank you very much, Gemma. It's great to be with you as always.
So, Dr. Adler, you have said that the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, quote, eviscerated a fundamental constitutional right, unquote. So can we get into that law? I mean, is the right to an abortion a constitutional right? And I ask that because that's part of the argument that we've heard from lawmakers saying, well, nowhere in the Constitution does it talk about abortion.
Right. That's a great question. The reality is that since 1973, the Supreme Court has said consistently that women enjoy a fundamental right to an abortion. And it doesn't matter that some dispute that decision based on the fact that it lacks an enumeration in the Constitution, because, of course, in addition to enumerated rights in the Constitution, we Americans also enjoy unenumerated rights, as the Supreme Court has said on many, many occasions, and which critics of Roe versus Wade have agreed. For example, we all know that we have a right to travel from city to city, from state to state. That's not enumerated in the Constitution. We also believe that we have freedom of association, which is not enumerated. That's derived from the freedom to assemble. So we have any number of implied rights, and the court has always treated implied rights as equal to the importance of enumerated rights. So, Gemma, it's of no importance, of no moment, that people would dismiss Roe versus Wade because it rests on an unenumerated right. In fact, this particular court, which is like to invoke historical traditions in American law, conveniently ignored that at the founding of our nation, early states did in fact permit abortions up until the point of quickening, roughly 3 months. And so there was an early acknowledgement by the very men who founded our nation that there will be circumstances in which women on an individual basis, probably in consultation with their physicians, would make a decision to seek an abortion. So we have, in fact, a long history in our country, like other nations in the world, of seeking recourse to abortions. And the Supreme Court in 1973 in Roe versus Wade did not, in fact, cut a right to abortion out of whole cloth or spin it from thin air. And the important thing, I think, to point out to the audience is that subsequent to Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court on several occasions upheld Roe versus Wade, and those affirmations of a fundamental right, and that's how the court referred to Roe, those affirmations were, in fact, the voices of not merely Supreme Court nominees of Democratic presidents, but also Republican presidents. So there'd been a consistent line until this court in June struck it down. And that did represent a raw power grab by this ultra-conservative majority that controls the Supreme Court.
So I want to ask you just a simple question to explain what an unenumerated right is, because we've heard this term quite a bit, but some folks may not understand what that is.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. The reality is that unenumerated rights are sometimes characterized as implied rights. These are rights that we enjoy by virtue of the Bill of Rights that the court has identified over many, many years, and it ranges from, for example, the right to travel to the right to privacy. Right to privacy is not mentioned in the Constitution either. And the Supreme Court said in 1965 in Griswold versus Connecticut that the right to privacy is a fundamental right, though it is unenumerated, and it derives from several provisions in our Constitution. The court explained, for example, that it is found in the context of freedom of speech and freedom of religion, where we all, as free citizens, have the right to contemplate our thoughts, the right to, for example, consider our relationship to the universe or the relationship to God. And we also have the right to formulate our political views and think about our positions on issues. This area of the mind, which Justice Robert Jackson eloquently wrote about in the 1943 landmark decision, he referred to that as the inner sanctum of the mind that the government cannot penetrate, unlike a totalitarian system where the government would control your right to express yourself and even attempt to govern what you might think. The court said in 1943 that there is this inner sanctum of the mind. He might as well have said there's a right to privacy, to think our thoughts, and as I say, to consider our relationship to the universe. And the court went on to say that there is this right to privacy found in the Fourth Amendment, for example, our right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, and the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, and other clauses of the Constitution in the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, the broad liberty interest that we enjoy under the Due Process Clause protected by the 14th Amendment certainly contemplates a right to privacy. What the court has said eloquently about the right of women, for example, to govern their reproductive organs on the basis of personal autonomy. If there's no sense of personal autonomy protected by the liberty provision in the Due Process Clause, then we have no personal rights. We have no ability to think our thoughts or make the most fundamental decisions about our reproductive organs.
So then, are you concerned that other unenumerated rights could be overturned? I mean, let's talk about this. You said the right to travel. I mean, there are states right now that are trying to limit women's right to travel in order to get an abortion in a state that allows it. Interracial marriage, that's not in the Constitution. So, you know, reproductive rights, I mean, contraception, that's not in the Constitution. So, I mean, this brings up so many questions and frankly, concerns about, you know, what our rights really are, in particular, if you happen to be a person with a uterus.
Well, you're certainly right. That's the question of the moment in our nation. And when Justice Alito, in his majority opinion for the court in the Dobbs case, coupled with the concurrence of Justice Clarence Thomas, scoffed at the idea that the 14th Amendment protects a right to privacy or protects a sense of liberty broad enough to encompass the very rights and practices that you mentioned, then we do have to be very alarmed about the future of these rights. Think about an America, for example, in which women and men would not have a right to access contraceptive devices. Justice Thomas would cut the ground from beneath the court's rationale for protecting that right. Or as you mentioned, same-sex marriage certainly would be on the line, or the, you know, the right of the LGBT community to engage in the same kinds of sexual activities as heterosexuals. What's interesting, you know, Gemma, is that Justice Thomas did not include in that category the right to interracial marriage. And that seems so obviously self-serving. And in fact, I have to say that that fits the theme of this majority, that finally it has the power to promote its ultra-conservative agenda. And despite the fact that there are tall precedents standing in the way of overturning these fundamental rights, that's not going to deter this majority. And so that's why We are justly concerned about the future of our rights and liberties. And I would say that Americans should not have to fear, as Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan eloquently put it, that their legal rights and liberties hang by a thread contingent upon a change in personnel on the Supreme Court. The fact of the matter is that this right to privacy that is undergirds the right to an abortion was what the former senator from Pennsylvania, the Republican conservative senator Arlen Specter, once referred to as, quote, a super duper precedent. Now, that may be a technical term, a super duper precedent that was so fundamental. And the reality is that at least two justices nominated by President Trump said before the Judiciary Committee that the law was well settled, that in fact Roe was well entrenched in our constitutional tradition, a 50-year-old precedent. And so it simply doesn't wash now that this court in Dobbs would so in such a cavalier way, throw that out of our constitutional boat. That's very, very troubling.
And you say that the decision to overturn Roe was made by what you call a radical majority on the court, and you say this undermines the court's legitimacy. And I would argue that this court right now tends to be overwhelmingly conservative. The same argument could be made for a court that is overwhelmingly liberal. There seems to be no balance on the court right now. And isn't that supposed to be the premise of the court to represent, you know, what the U.S. looks like in particular when they take up these cases? So, A, am I correct in that assumption? And B, what does that do to the legitimacy of the court when it is so weighted on one side, whether that be liberal or conservative?
Oh, that's a wonderful, insightful question. The reality is that the Supreme Court justices themselves have known for roughly 200 years that the ultimate power or authority of the Supreme Court hinges on its prestige, its standing with the American public, because the public, of course, has to adhere to the decisions rendered by the court. And therefore, the court has always been keen to maintain its legitimacy by not willy-nilly overturning precedents, certainly not well-heeled, entrenched fundamental precedents that are 50 years old or so, that in fact are fully defensible. And so the court essentially is comprised of justices who are the gatekeepers of judicial legitimacy. When the court begins to turn its back on these well-heeled precedents, it undercuts the public's confidence in the court. And people start to say to themselves, are these judges simply behaving like legislators? And so when the justices behave in this manner, overthrowing precedents, then we wonder about, we ask the question, why is the court the repository of such awesome authority if in fact it's going to wield this power in a way that simply promotes the preferences, the proclivities, the prejudices of individual justices? So that's why the court has always been concerned to maintain stability in our system by upholding stare decisis. Now, of course, it is true that there have been precedents that have been overturned, but justly so. And many critics of the decision will say, well, the court overturned Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, some 60 years later in 1954 in Brown versus the Board of Education. But the reality, Emma, is that in that case, the court was correcting an error so obvious when the court committed that error in 1896 by upholding separate but equal, wholly inconsistent with the 14th Amendment. That's not the case in the Dobbs decision, where in fact the court had overturned a decision that had been reiterated, reaffirmed by liberal and conservative justices ever since Roe came down. It is, of course, also possible, as you point out, that there can be liberals dominating the court that would overturn precedents. And that's occurred, certainly. But the reality is, to your wonderful point. We the people want to know that our Supreme Court, and in fact the judiciary as a whole, is proceeding in a way that upholds precedent, and so we're not startled or indeed shocked to wake up one morning, as America did the day after the Dobbs decision was rendered, to hear that a fundamental right of women has been removed from much of America.
Well, it seems, I mean, as you point out, the Brown decision, how that, you know, overturned precedent, but, you know, it got rid of separate but equal. This precedent overturning Roe v. Wade basically feels, and one would argue does, make women second-class citizens all of a sudden, because we no longer have a right to our own bodies.
I think that's true. And I'm not alone in saying that. Justice O'Connor, the first woman named to the Supreme Court, and it's, as it happened, by a very conservative Republican president, Ronald Reagan, in 1981, said in a Pennsylvania abortion case that upheld the essence of Roe versus Wade, that without the right to govern her reproductive organs, women are relegated to second-class citizenship, because then they can't proceed to make the kinds of decisions that would govern the rest of their lives, educational choices, professional choices, and how to lead their lives. So this effort to win the right to abortion, like the long effort to win right to contraceptives, goes right to the heart of the women's rights movement. And many thought that it was too late in the day now for the high tribunal in this country to undercut the fundamental right of women to whole citizenship. Justice O'Connor, as I say, is a fine voice and a fine spokesperson for this point of view. And she was a very conservative member of the Supreme Court.
Continuing our conversation with Dr. David Adler, and right now we're going to be discussing a bit more about the January 6th hearings. As you might recall, last week, the head of the House committee investigating the January 6th attack at the U.S. Capitol said the panel would hold another hearing on September 28th. Well, then later said that date could change. The committee held 8 hearings in June and July, and a final report is expected at some point this fall. The 2021 attack put a halt to the constitutional process for certifying the 2020 presidential election, something that Dr. David Adler, as a constitutional scholar, has a particular interest in. He also says, though, that the attack and the investigation into it should be of interest to everyone. And Dr. Adler is the president of the nonprofit Altruis Institute, and he will be talking about the hearings on Friday at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Boise State. And he will once again talk about this in November over in Idaho Falls. And he's staying with us to talk a bit more about this. So, Dr. Adler, the attack at the Capitol on January 6, 2021, as I mentioned, stopped the counting and the certification of the Electoral College votes. What was supposed to happen procedurally that day?
You know, we're talking about an unprecedented moment in the history of our nation. When we look at what the efforts of the insurrectionists aimed to accomplish that day, they aimed to stop Congress from certifying the Electoral College vote, which was the last step, usually administrative, usually ceremonial in nature, to verify that in this particular case, Joe Biden had won the presidency. By stopping the count for a few hours, the insurrectionists were engaging in what can only be fairly described as an effort to stop our constitutional system. That is, in a word, a coup. And the very fact that they did succeed in delaying that vote for a few moments shocked the conscience of the nation, because we're a nation, Gemma, that is committed to the peaceful transfer of power. And that's what the supporters of Donald Trump were undercutting. They were seeking to deny that peaceful transfer of power, which we've done so well, so beautifully since George Washington left the office and John Adams mm-hmm. became the second president of the United States. So it's shocking. It's deeply frightening. It represented an unprecedented attack on our constitutional tradition. And that's why the January 6th committee conducting these hearings is undertaking, in my view, the most important investigation ever conducted in the history of the United States Congress.
So let's talk a little bit more about that then, this House Select Committee hearings that we saw in June and July. Have we seen an investigation of this level before?
You know, the thing that comes closest, I think, Gemma, is, and many of your listeners will recall it, the Watergate Select Committee investigating President Richard Nixon's crimes against the Constitution and the nation. And we saw how gravely threatened our constitutional system was as the Watergate hearings revealed how the president and his henchmen had worked in concert to undermine the laws of the United States and to deny the full thrust of constitutional protections. And we were shocked. And we thought, well, we survived Watergate. We now have remedies, programs, and laws in place to prevent it. But I have to say that those hearings, as important as they were, historically important in the disclosures and the revelations that they shared with the American public, as important as they are, still take only second place to the importance of these hearings. Because what we found, of course, is that the most high-ranking officials in the American government were behind this effort to stop the count of the Electoral College on January 6th. And this, of course, includes the former president of the United States. There is mounting evidence that he was involved in a role to orchestrate and to coordinate and organize this effort, which reflected, of course, his earlier efforts to overturn the election. And indeed, his statement, his declaration, wholly false, that in fact the election was rigged. And of course, this is what promotes the big lie, as we characterize it quite properly, being advanced by any number of Trump supporters and other Republicans who must be Trump supporters from coast to coast as they seek office in the 2022 campaign, who are, quite frankly, election deniers. And not only do they deny the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election, but they are quite willing to say they may not accept the results in 22 or perhaps 24. Mm-hmm. So, Gemma, the great threat to our republic reflected in the attack on the Capitol, that reflected also the efforts by the former president to cling to power despite his overwhelming defeat, represent a grave threat to American democracy, well beyond the threats posed by Watergate.
Well, what is sometimes difficult, I think, to comprehend, and I don't think I will ever forget watching this coup happen as I was sitting in my living room watching this on television and watching it unfold, is that if this had been successful, our democracy would have fallen. And how do we look at that, whether you believe the big lie or not? We would not be the United States of America, a democracy potentially, if this had been successful.
That's right. Your conclusion is certainly accurate, because we would have given way to a form of authoritarianism. And the reality is it would have been very difficult to put our democracy back on the proper rails. Once democracy is knocked off the track, so to speak, it requires a Herculean effort to put democracy in its full force back on track. And so much was at stake on that day. And you realize how close we came to mm-hmm. losing our democracy and the rule of law. This was a coup. We don't expect to see efforts to overthrow the government in the United States of America. We have seen them historically in other parts of the right. country, and not accustomed to seeing authoritarians try to seize power and oust democracy.
And then I know that you have been looking at former President Donald Trump's claim of executive privilege, in particular when it comes to this investigation. Are his claims valid?
No, they're not. Because, in fact, executive privilege can be invoked only by the incumbent president. And as the world knows, President Joe Biden refused to invoke executive privilege over these documents. And the great irony of Judge Cannon's decision 10 days or so ago, that in fact, former President Donald Trump enjoys executive privilege, is that her ruling finds no basis in American law, and certainly not in the seminal executive privilege case, that being United States versus Nixon in 1974, which only upheld a limited claim of executive privilege to withhold materials from agencies or department outside the executive branch, the courts possibly, Congress possibly, but did not at all pertain to an effort that we're seeing now on the part of the Department of Justice for an executive branch agency to conduct an investigation within the executive branch pertaining to executive branch materials. So this was a grotesque decision rendered by a young judge who barely met the minimum qualification for longevity in practice in law to be appointed to the court. And she's clearly ideologically motivated. It is deeply embarrassing for her court. And I'm happy now that the DOJ is appealing to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, because what we're witnessing here, what we've just witnessed in this decision, is an effort to recreate the doctrine of executive privilege to protect a former president's theft of documents over which he had no authority.
And, you know, I know some commentators are concerned that the January 6th committee and anything it does before the November election could impact the midterms. I'd like to talk about not just this committee, but also the DOJ investigation that is currently going on, as you mentioned. And I know that, you know, there's this idea that, well, 60 days before an election, you're supposed to kind of stop, right? So that the elections can be fair and balanced. Yet at the same time, let's go back to the 2016 election, when just days before the election, there was, you know, the DOJ dropped information about Hillary Clinton. So once again, it seems like we have, we're speaking out of both sides of our mouths here.
Well, you're right. The reality is this norm, something of a norm within the DOJ to avoid investigations that would affect the outcome of election, applies, as flimsy as it is, but it applies only to campaigns for people currently seeking office. It should not have any application to Donald Trump because he's not running in 2022. So that distinction has to be maintained. The other point, well made, on the interference by the FBI director in 2016, dropping information, that is, inserting his own view that then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had treated some emails and documents in a reckless manner, far exceeded the responsibilities of his office. But certainly it had a great impact on the election because she lost some 8 points in the polls with roughly 10 days to go, as you point out. And so the DOJ or the FBI should not have participated in the kind of commentary that FBI Director Comey engaged in 2016. And that certainly did fall within the channel of this norm: you shall not engage in action or investigation or an announcement that could affect the outcome of the election. Mm. So for partisans of Donald Trump to try to invoke this norm is inapt. It falls outside the range that the norm encompasses, and doesn't, because Trump is not seeking office in 2022. The fact of the matter is, Gemma, we are facing a crucial moment in our history. where a former president has absconded with governmental property, not personal property, governmental property, over which he had no legal claim, had no right to possess. And we don't know what is in those documents. As the world knows, there are a number of files that are empty that were marked top secret and classified. And we don't know what he has done with those documents. So there are all kinds of question marks. And the reality is the DOJ and the intelligence agencies need to be able to conduct this investigation unobstructed by any judicial interference. And so what we're witnessing here is a slowdown of this investigation by an ideologically motivated federal judge, and it has severely undercut our national security interests. We don't know if these documents have been sold by former President Trump for his own benefit or to exert leverage. The very fact that some countries now have to worry that their nuclear secrets have been shared with other nations, perhaps their adversaries, will undercut the U.S. ability in the future to make assurances to our allies that we can safeguard the secrets they choose to share with us. So the judge's decision to bring a halt to the DOJ's investigation, I think, reeks with disaster.
Mm. And before I let you go, I had mentioned that the January 6th committee had said they were going to hold another hearing September 28th, next week. Now they're saying this may change. Are you concerned that the committee's work, if they go ahead with hearings, I mean, this close to an election, will appear political in nature? But with that said, supporters of Donald Trump all believe that it is political in nature because of what they are investigating.
Right. And there's only so much we can do to affect the perceptions of Trump partisans. And the reality is they're unlikely to accept the legitimate findings of the January 6th committee, no matter what they end up showing. I think it's worth pointing out that next to the lawmaking function of Congress, the informing function is its next most important function. And as a matter of fact, President Woodrow Wilson once said that the informing function is as important as the lawmaking function. Congress can't function very well unless it gathers information so that it can write laws and develop programs and policies to well serve the nation, and programs, policies, and laws that can protect us against another effort undertaken by former president and his gang to overthrow the government. So I think at this point, and you certainly ask an important and fair question, I think at this point we should encourage the January 6th committee to proceed, to do its business. It's been very professional. It's been bipartisan. After all, Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican, has stood tall for the rule of law and democracy, representing what we used to believe was the mainstream of the Republican Party, which is now, of course, in thrall of Donald Trump. But the reality is we can't set aside these historically important hearings simply because they appear at a calendar time when we have campaigns underway. And Americans have a right to know the truth about January 6th. We have a right to know who organized, who participated in the coup and the effort to subvert our democracy by halting a fundamentally important constitutional process on January 6th.
Well, Dr. Adler, as always, appreciate your time to talk with us about all of this.
Thank you so much for having me. Always nice to be with you, Gemma. Take care.
I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters.